Ingrid und Indeed präsentieren Jobs, bei denen man sich keinen Fehler erlauben darf. Heute Steuerberaterin.
Wie sieht meine Steuererklärung aus?
Super Neuigkeiten. Sie müssen dieses Jahr keine Steuern zahlen.
Wie?
Ich habe drauf geschrieben, nein, danke. Das Finanzamt muss das respektieren.
Ingrid!
Das ist ein Job für Premium-Stellenanzeigen. Mit richtigen Profis wäre das nicht passiert. Vertrau Ingrid. Versuch Indeed. Und finde qualifizierte Talente mit Premium-Stellenanzeigen. Mach's dir Indeed einfach. Jetzt auf Indeed.de/recruiting.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. One of the classics. It's one of the classics. That's where we are now, culturally. WTF. Oh, that one's a classic. It's one of the originals. Yeah, still audio. Still doing it old school. What's going on? So, look. Robert Patrick is on the show. You know Robert Patrick from his role in Terminator 2 as the bad Terminator, but he's been in dozens of movies and TV shows, including his current roles on Reacher and The Peacemaker, and an amazing turn in The Sopranos, I thought. And look, we all know this guy as a sort of, a heavy in the movies. And the reason he's on the show is I ran into him at LAX and we started talking and he knew me and I knew him and he was excited to meet me and I was excited to meet him. He told me, gave me a card for, he's part owner of a Harley dealership. And, I thought this guy would be interesting. So he's on the show today. How you doing? You holding up? Man, it's going to be a rough week and then maybe a rough rest of time. Right? One outcome? Horrendous. The fucking worst. How are we going to deal? The other outcome? Manageable. And at least a little wiggle room to try to still maintain humanity at a level of tolerance and decency. But only half of us. The people I'm talking to here, I know who you are. You know who you need to vote for. Vote for Kamala. What the fuck is the question? I don't know what can I tell you to do? I'm getting texts from people like, do you have any ideas on how to handle this? Well, it's out of your hands. It's out of your control. I would say try to maintain your sanity and not, fall into a fucking pit of anxiety and fear and terror and turn it in on yourself and, decide that you don't know if you can handle it or manage it or just kind of like preemptively despair or do something dramatic, use it as an excuse to relapse or to, suicide yourself because you've turned this in all on yourself because of you're afraid. Look, we're all afraid, at least half of us. And some people are very at risk, marginalized people of one kind or another are at risk for their lives. Because of the anger out there and the intolerance out there and the violence out there, there are many people, LGBTQ community, the immigrant population, with the amount of propaganda put out by the tech oligarchs and their minions in the new media platforms. What is happening has never been so, in this country, so shameless and so apparent. Fascism is good for big business, and the minions who have now, kind of created their own show business industrial complex and are towing the line for these fucking fascists and humanizing them and normalizing them, they're of it, but it's all part of the grift. When there's an autocrat, you want to suck up to him so you can be, get in the money line. There are decent, tolerant, empathetic people out there. There's more of them than the other if they haven't crumbled into themselves. I'm hoping for the best, or at least the better. I guess the only thing you can do is try to convince the people that who are making a statement by not voting or voting for Jill Stein or whoever that it's just, I don't know, is it time for those kind of personal statements? I'm going to get flack from full-on lefties who are like, the two-party system, it's all corrupt. What about Israel? What about, corporate rule? What about, I know. I know. I understand all that. And you can keep fighting the good fight. But, and I said this the last time, you know, if fascism takes hold, that fight becomes a very different fight. And your sort of, you know, ideological righteousness even has less of a voice. But maybe you can carve out a little place for yourself and live with yourself. But look, I don't know what to tell the people that are panicking and panicking at me because, you know, I'm in the middle of my own panic. I voted. I sent it in. I did my bit. I've supported publicly who I support. You know who it is. I've said it before. Vote for Kamala. It's not a big leap. I don't know what undecided means, really. You know, you vote for a blustering, full-on, shameless, proud fascist, or you vote for somebody who has at least the cultural and hopefully the political interests of what the country really looks like in place. Billions of people have had to adapt to this kind of political shift in their countries in this planet. Billions. The big issue becomes when you have a world run by a handful of autocratic fuckheads who are in cahoots with each other, you know, what happens to Europe? I don't know. What happens to the Middle East? I don't know. But if the idea is not some sort of global alliance fighting against fascism, and it becomes a global alliance of fascistic and autocratic leaders, I don't know whether everyone does, and I don't know what culture looks like. But we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Just don't hurt yourself, for fuck's sake. Yeah, you know, I'm back at it this week. Got two more weeks on this movie. Last week was kind of amazing. I worked with Lily Gladstone last Thursday and Friday. Just me and her, one-on-one. She plays my therapist, and it was a high point. It was a high point in the life of my creative life and my life in general. I love Lily. We had a nice time, and I think we did good work. But onward we go. It's not over yet. Jesus. I don't want to, you know, in the midst of all this chaos and fear, I don't want to say that, like, well, I think I'm doing my best work and I might even be enjoying myself. And I'm telling you, that experience I had with Sharon Stone last week has changed my approach to creativity, to comedy, to how I enter into the moment of how I take the stage. It's so rare that you have some sort of creative breakthrough, personal breakthrough when you're old. And it's just mind-blowing. And I applied it the other night at Dynasty. Just sort of, how can I explain it? Look, I know I'm a good comic. I've been doing it a long time. But there is part of the job of comic where, you know, it's sort of when you take the stage, it's sort of like, I got to get them. I got to go in strong. I got to use this bit and that bit. But if you work improvisationally like I do to sort of build your stuff, you know, sometimes I'll start riffing only because I'm so tired of my other stuff and I got to get something new out. And, you know, I just start to kind of go for it and see what happens. But then something happened after kind of breaking myself open with Sharon Stone in that moment. In that scene, like when I go on stage now, it's sort of like, just trust yourself, stupid. You know, don't worry about the fucking audience and getting them. I mean, I'm operating at a different frequency than most comics. I'm just, you know, I just have a different presence. And it's sort of like, you don't have to apologize for that or overcompensate for it. Just trust yourself. I mean, Jesus Christ, you must be funny. Come on, Mark. Just go up there and open yourself up and just let it happen. Be funny. And the freedom of mind will come if you don't worry about the audience judging you. Yeah, you would think I would have nailed that already. And I kind of do, but it's usually with a fury, not with a sort of openness. So that's kind of happening. And I have to thank Sharon Stone again for it. Quick observation. I had an interesting cat observation. So, look, I've got this cat who's an asshole, Charlie. He's a good cat, and, you know, I love him, but he's like a classic asshole. he's not a bad cat. He just does everything that cats can do to, you know, annoy you and make them amazing. It's that weird line. It's like, could you be just a little less cat in every way, breaking shit? Yeah, he's just one of these, you know, people come over. He's like, he's a great cat. I'm like, yeah, you're here. When friends come, when people come over, he's like Mr. Charm. You know, when they leave, you know, I got to pull him off the fucking ceiling or the drapes or, you know, from under something or stop him from eating plastic or knocking cans over and glasses over and not coming in from the catio because he thinks it's fun. It's just, I love it. I love watching Charlie play with the little scrunchie ball. You know, those little scrunchies, like, and you throw it and he'll fetch it, man. And I just, you know, you just love watching a cat go crazy with a scrunchie ball. But it's what I do. I don't know what you like watching your cat do. I like throwing it and fetching it and watching him play with the ball. But within like 8 minutes, the ball is always going to end up under the stove. And no, it doesn't matter what part of the house it's in. Somehow or another, he'll get it under the stove. And so, like, I'm down there yesterday, you know, he got it under the stove and I got the broom out. So I'm using the whole broom handle and the light on my phone to kind of you know, maneuver this ball out from under the stove. And he's sitting there just watching the whole thing. And, you know, I got it out from under the stove and I look at Charlie and I had this moment where I'm like, oh my God, he likes watching me play with the ball as much as I like to watch him playing with the ball. There's a reciprocity there. This isn't a one-sided thing. I'm not getting the ball for Charlie. Charlie likes watching me fucking get the ball out from under the stove. See that? Same level shit. Robert Patrick is like, he's a real fucking deal dude, man. He didn't really have anything to plug here, so we just told him we'd let everyone know he's the co-owner of Harley Davidson of Santa Clarita. If you're going to buy a motorcycle, go get one from Robert. But this was kind of a great conversation. This is me talking to Robert Patrick.
Let's talk about hair. Yeah. I got to figure out what to do with my hair. I want to grow it long again, but it just doesn't seem to be the thing anymore. What happened?
Well, how long do you want to grow it?
Well, I used to have it down to here. I mean,
I guess there's two styles of biker. Yeah, it depends which one you want to be.
Which one do I want to be? Exactly. Exactly.
What do you want to look like, man? Which type of menace are you trying to exude?
I'm a good guy on a motorcycle. I'm in retail, baby. I sell Harleys, man.
I had a buddy who sold Harleys. You know Dean Del Rey?
I do know that name.
Yeah, years ago he used to sell Harley. He's a comic, but he knows bikes. He was I don't know where he sold them, but it was a while back. But he used to be a bike guy, and then he was actually on the way to my old house, and somebody ran him off someone like hit him on the freeway, and he went down, it fucked him up, man. He didn't break anything. He was lucky, but he got pretty ripped up, and that was it. Turned it in.
That's sad.
Yeah. Sad what? That he's not riding anymore? Or that
fuck
it happened?
Yeah. Sad he's not riding anymore. You gotta get back on the horse, man.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I've gone down. I went down on the 170, smashed my hand up pretty bad. It's a funny story.
Yeah. What happened?
Well, I don't know. Do I want to save this? Are we rolling? Is this
sure,
it?
Yeah.
Is this how it happens?
Yeah.
It's just like that.
Just eases in.
I need to know. I need to
switch up? You got to get into character?
No, I just want to make sure I know what I say at all times. I'm a very cautious.
Always?
I want to think
new
about
thing?
It. I don't know what. I don't know if it's a new thing anymore.
Yeah.
I'm at that point, you know, I'm 65. I'll be 66 in about 20 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything you think and your philosophies and what you think you're doing and all that kind of shit changes up. And
it does, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I just turned 61.
You punk.
I know. A few years
Look
behind
at you.
Yeah, yeah, but we're in the same zone.
You know, we know some of the same people.
Yeah, like who?
Alejandro Escovedo.
Oh, yeah, man. I love that guy.
You know, I sang with him twice.
Oh, it's the best. He let me play with him up in Vancouver.
No shit.
Yeah, we did.
Just recently?
Yeah, when I was up there shooting that show, he let me sit in with the guys, let me play his heavy old 73 Les Paul, and we did Beast of Burden and Like a Hurricane. It was great.
Oh, that's so cool.
How do you know him?
I envy you. Mm. How do I know him? Well, it's a great story. Nancy Rankin, his wife,
yeah,
was my hair girl on Dusk Till Dawn that I was doing in Austin, Texas.
Oh, okay.
And I came into the hair trailer and I said, hey, I just saw this fantastic performer at the Moody doing something with... Rocky Erickson.
Oh, yeah.
You know him?
Yeah, sure.
Rest his soul. And I was just going off on, you know, Alejandro.
Yeah.
And she goes, you like Alejandro? And I go, yeah, he's fucking great. You know, he's a great songwriter.
Yeah, oh, totally.
And she says, that's my fiance. This is before they got married.
Uh-huh.
And through Nancy and getting to know Alejandro, he did a Leonard Cohen kind of... I don't want to say retrospective. I don't know if that's correct, but he did a night of like Leonard Cohen songs and some of his songs.
Yeah.
And he asked me to come down and do like Leonard Cohen, three songs.
Oh, yeah.
And I was studying. I immediately went and studied with a vocal coach. I had like 3 months to find out if I could sing. Yeah.
Could you sing?
Yeah. I'm a G.
Yeah.
And I found a range.
Yeah.
And I showed up. I had the three songs. Of course, he gave me a teleprompter. You know, he said, we'll have the words there, so freak the fuck out.
Right.
And I took the stage and with a chorus and did three Leonard Cohen songs. And I showed up. I said, hey, man, I can sing these.
Yeah.
And he went, and we did one sound check, and I did the show. A couple of years later, maybe two or so, he said, hey, I want you to come back to the Moody and... do you want to do that song you released with your brother? I don't know if you know who my brother is.
From Filter.
Yeah, Richard Patrick had written a song, a needle drop for a movie I produced.
Yeah.
Called Oh Lord.
Okay.
And so Alejandro invited me to come sing that with his band.
Yeah.
And I had one soundtrack, one sound check, and then did it on stage at the Moody. And I got to tell you, the whole experience from an actor's point of view, Mark, you're multi. Dimensional entertainer, you comedian, guitarist, actor. You know, I'm just an actor.
Right.
So, I mean, I had invited Jewel. She was there.
She's
with
the best.
I love her.
Oh, my God. How do you know her?
I met her on my way to Austin, Texas. We're getting an espresso somewhere, and we kind of noticed that we both knew who each other was.
Right.
So we sat together and had some coffee.
Oh, God, I interviewed her. She's the best.
She's a wonderful, wonderful lady.
Oh, my God.
What a spirit. I connected with her, and I think she had a boyfriend that was a quarterback. I want to say like Charlie Whitehorse or something
that.
Something like that.
Anyway, yeah.
But I invited them to the show. So she came to the show.
Oh, and so you nervous as fuck?
Dude, getting back to it. Yeah, you go, you know, you approach. I mean, I rehearsed at home.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny how I did that. I set up a PA system in my living room, played the song, sang with the song.
Yeah.
And that's how I rehearsed. I remember my son was still living with us at the time. And he would come out and watch me and kind of give me some tips because he's a singer.
Yeah.
And then I just let it rip. My brother went with me, and my backup singer went with me.
Yeah.
We've got a very kind of a background vocalist where it's kind of like Gimme Shelter, you know, kind of.
Oh, yeah, the soul.
She just ripped it. And we had to add all that kind of stuff because I can't get to certain, you know, I've got a range, but it's not a broad range.
I tell you, man, there was nothing more frightening than singing. In public. Nothing like, you know, I do comedy, you know, for my whole life.
Yeah.
And I've been playing guitar my whole life. And then I just started to say, fuck it. I got to overcome whatever this fear is because I love doing it. Yeah. But boy, when you start singing, it's just like it's somehow or another. Nothing feels more vulnerable than that to me.
Oh,
and
I know.
And I don't know if it's the risk of failure or because your voice, you have no control over it being such a pure representation of you. But boy, the idea of singing badly. In front of people, I'd rather fucking put a gun in my mouth.
That's a little extreme, Mark.
Yeah.
But I understand you. I You just got to, it's just like acting. Sooner or later, you got to let your balls drop onto the stage, man. You got to,
no,
gotta,
I know.
And I know you know, because I know you do that.
I can't stop my balls from dropping almost anywhere.
Well, yeah. You got to hold them up while you're taking them. Anyway.
Yeah.
I did, and I loved it. And I have to tell you, yeah. I mean, I'm a singer.
You are.
I'm fucking, I love doing it. I've disappointed myself that I haven't. There was a time when I was really trying to figure out if I was going to try to record more songs and do some more stuff. But it's all about money. And then that involves what I got to do for my career and the other things I've got, you know, other things that I've got to take care of, my business. I got my Harley Davidson business. I've got all these things that I'm focused on. And it's like, I just haven't had time to focus.
But I mean, like for me, like I used to do a bit about it. Like I never wanted to do professional music. So now my guitars, they're a hobby that I enjoy doing. They're not broken dream vessels. They don't represent some sort of failure or something that didn't happen. So I keep it pretty pure. Like I record things on here, but I would never, you know, I don't know. Like it'd be fun. I'd have been in a studio with dudes before and that's fun, but I would never think of it as a money-making venture. It would just ruin it.
Well, I don't think I ever got to the point where I was thinking it was a money-making adventure. Yeah. I was worried it was going to cost me money.
Oh, you were going to. Right.
It was just going to be money I'm flushing down the toilet for absolutely
no reason. For studio time, paying
the
other guys.
That's where my
head went.
But I did a couple other very small live performances with some other bands, and I must say I really got into it. Well, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's where it really happens, you know? But you're confident enough, you walk off stage and you think like, I did it.
I fucking nailed it. I was the great, you know, I approached it, Mark, like, I'm the greatest rock and roll star of all time.
Yeah, well, I missed my calling.
I told myself that before I took stage. I see, it's the same with acting. Your mind is so powerful. You can convince yourself of that.
Yeah.
And you can actually get in there and get into character and go out and do it.
That's how you prepare?
Well, that's a little more difficult than that, but that's one of the things you do. I think in life, period.
You got to believe.
If you can't fucking believe it, who's going to believe it? Right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, you have to get up and address people, do public speaking, stuff like that.
Well,
you just have to kind of talk yourself into, I'm good at it.
Yeah.
And if you don't think you're good at it, then you're not going to be good at it.
Well, my thing is I like to bring the audience in on the fact that I don't think I'm very good at it.
Well, that's part of your...
Yeah.
It's part of it,
but it's honest.
It's true. I get you.
We're starting at ground level.
Anything up
from here is going to be good. Look, the guy's he's pulling it off.
Hey, well, it's more than I expected. He's got more going on than I thought he had. Look at that.
Yeah, he really set us up for disappointment at the beginning. Yeah, but, well, a nice surprise.
Low expectations were set.
Yeah.
He overcame them all. Well,
a hero's journey.
I've seen you on stage.
Yeah.
You're very funny.
Oh, thank you.
I haven't been there in person. I've seen you on TV.
Yeah.
Like,
but, well, the acting thing's all, it's all, I still feel like it's relatively new for me. And like, I had Pacino in here the other night, you know. And
name dropper.
Sure, I am.
Let me get that for
you. Yeah, I'll take it. There's a few other ones down there.
I'm very well aware of who I've sat in this chair.
Well, I mean, for me, though, because I'm acting, you know, I want to glean something because I've always thought there was some, you know, this mystery to it, you know, in the sense that, like, there's a way to do it right. And as I talk to actors over time, it's just like you're going to figure out whatever way you got to do. You know, there's no one way, and there's no, you know, and also I think a lot of it is just natural. I think like 80% is you just have a natural ability to fucking, you know, focus in, turn off the rest and do it and listen and engage. But there are tricks. Like I'm very hard on myself. You?
I'm surprised at how successful I am.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I had those low expectations, but it was something I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, but I sit back and watch my work and I think, I'll watch something like once.
Yeah.
There's movies I haven't seen. So
that
I haven't,
you've done?
Yeah, that I haven't seen that I haven't looked at. Not because I just don't really have an interest.
Yeah.
I enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Have a lot of fun with it. There's a lot of technique that I've learned over the years.
Yeah.
You know, I've been doing it 40 years.
I know, it's crazy, right?
And I just went out to Hollywood and got started with Roger Corman. I started, it was trial by fire.
But what was it, but where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Atlanta, Boston, Atlanta, Dayton, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, Cleveland.
What the fuck is that about?
What the fuck?
Yeah.
It's my dad was 24 when he had me, started Lockheed Aircraft Corporation.
Doing what?
He was finance guy.
Oh, yeah?
He was finance. He even went to Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
Quit his job there. No, wait. We went to Boston. He got his master's from MIT. We went back to Atlanta. You smart guy. Rubbed off on me too.
Yeah.
He went to Atlanta. Then he quit. He left Lockheed. Went into the banking industry.
Yeah.
That was in Dayton, Ohio, Winters Bank. Then he went to Detroit. He was at Bank of the Commonwealth, which was the bank that was bought by King Fahdy.
Yeah. Oh, I kind of remember that.
Remember that narrative? Yeah, the first bank bought by the Saudis?
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad, I don't think he realized what he was getting involved with in Detroit.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of...
Yeah, sure.
And he kind of like went, oh, fuck, I made a mistake. I got five kids. We got to get out of here.
Five.
And he moved to Cleveland.
On the run?
On the run. Moved to Cleveland, got a gig with a key bank there. And I stayed in Detroit and finished my senior year of high school there.
It's so funny, the way you're setting that story up, I was waiting for the lost everything part.
No, he didn't. He didn't lose everything. He did okay. He did okay. He did retire early at an awkward age, I think 58 years old.
That's not bad.
58 to take a golden parachute retirement with a six-figure deal.
Did he have a good time?
He played a lot of golf.
Well, I mean, that's what they do, some of them. You play golf?
No, I can't stand golf. What a waste of fucking time.
Try to connect.
I ride motorcycles, dude.
I know.
That's all I do.
I know. I thought maybe you had this other side.
Yeah.
This secret side, the golf playing side.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of my friends do play golf.
I know. I just did 3 months on a golf show. I know nothing about it.
Are you a left-hander or right-handed?
I'm right-handed. But I mean, I had to play like a retired caddy.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, but I didn't have to, like I told
you.
Yeah,
see, I could see you doing that.
Sure.
I'm looking at you right now, and there's so many ways I could cast you, and I don't know you that
Yeah,
well.
Yeah.
I met you in the American Airlines lounge.
I know.
Where the fuck were you going? You were going to do a comedy show.
Yeah, probably.
I was going to go sign autographs, do a personal appearance.
At a con.
Doing a con, man.
A con.
You ever done a con?
No, I'm not popular with the nerds.
Yeah, it's one of my saving graces. I am popular with the nerds.
The nerds like you because you're the bad guy.
Well, you know, when you do one really substantial special effects science fiction movie,
and you're in for life.
You're in for life.
You're
with
making
the sci-fi
a little cash on each signature.
Hey, to me, it's like being on tour.
Yeah, of course.
It's like, hey, I can't play songs for you, but I can sit here and be a nice guy for you.
Yeah. So wait, now let me put this together. How many? You're the oldest or in the middle? Where are you?
I'm the oldest.
Really?
You're trying to figure something out here on me, aren't
no,
you?
No, I'm just trying to relate.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to relate.
Where are you in the pecking order?
Just me and my brother, my little brother, my poor little brother.
So what does he do?
He's, it's always vague, but it's sales of some kind. Nothing dubious, but he explains to me when he gets a job what he's doing, and I'm like, I lost you. I mean, it's a tech thing. What are you selling? He was in franchise food for a while, and he's kind of, you know, kicked around big ideas, but he's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was, I was a lot, so he kind of came up behind me, and I sucked a lot of the attention out of the air. He was a tennis guy. He was a tennis pro when he was a kid.
Were you an athlete?
Not really. I think I'm built for it. I can do it. I exercise now, but I don't like a competition that isn't mental or emotional. I wish I'd learned about team sports. I think it teaches you how to lose with a little dignity.
Yeah, I did a lot of team sports growing up.
What? Like what?
I was a football player, baseball. I wrestled for a while.
You wrestled?
I was undefeated wrestler all the way up to junior high, and then when I moved to Detroit, there was a wrestler there that had never lost. His name was Mark Chiarelli. Went on to be one of the greatest wrestlers in the real wrestling world.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mark Chiarella.
Yeah.
So that was the end of my career there. But I did
meet you.
I didn't even attempt. I just sized him up and went, oh, shit. This guy hasn't lost ever? No, he's like, you know.
And that was the end of your career?
He was a superstar. Well, I still had baseball and football.
Sure.
And so during the winter months in Detroit, I worked as a maintenance guy for a little shopping center.
Uh-huh.
I changed light bulbs, shoveled snow. Yeah. And had a girlfriend very heavy all the way through high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of thing. But I love football and baseball. You know, when I was growing up, look, I was born in 1958.
Yeah, sure.
You're 63. 61, so you were 63.
63, yeah.
You know, you had your baseball and you had your football.
Yeah, yeah, that was it.
And there was some basketball involved there,
But did your dad like it, too?
I think my father, he loved sports.
Yeah.
He was asthmatic.
Yeah.
And my father's father was a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. He fought in World War One, World War Two, and Korea, Bronze Star.
Yeah. Wow.
And was still active duty at Fort Bragg in North Carolina when he passed away from cancer.
Yeah.
At my age of 65. And I think my dad, asthmatic, wasn't a big athlete growing up.
But he liked it.
He was a trumpet player.
Yeah.
He was a trumpet player. He loved music.
Yeah.
And he was a really good trumpet player. I think he did that to help him with the asthma.
Yeah.
But he was a terrible golfer. But he loved it.
Well, you know, here's what I realize about golf is that, like, not unlike fucking drugs. It's like, if you nail that ball once, if you hit it, if you connect,
yeah,
and you do that thing, and you watch it, that rush of that one time, you'll chase it for the rest of your fucking life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you might get it, kind of, but you know, I don't think you hit it that much. But if you get that one taste and you've got the personality, life.
Yeah, I can see that being addiction.
Totally.
I was good when I lived in Georgia. I played golf left-handed. My childhood friend of mine, Kenny Andrews, went on to be a pro golfer.
Yeah.
And he was a buddy I played baseball with. His father was a All-American baseball player at the University of Georgia. Anyway, he was a fantastic athlete. He went on to be a tour pro, Ken Andrews.
Yeah.
And I gave it up somewhere in junior high, and I think because it was baseball, football, and I was a maintenance guy.
Yeah. Well, what'd you learn what do you take with you? What are the life lessons of a sports dreams of a kid and playing that much and being that dedicated to it?
Well, you know, I understand kids that are that dedicated to it. There's a lot of team, expectations put on you to perform. It relates to being in an ensemble in a movie.
Yeah.
You understand how an orchestra works, you know,
sure,
like that's your moment and you better be ready, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So the willingness to be able to perform, the ability to perform on demand when it's expected of you.
Yeah.
I think that all helps me.
Yeah. But you never, your insecurity never brought you down. I guess you build confidence with the sports, huh?
I think you build confidence with the sports, yeah. Yeah. It's funny, wrestling being an individual thing and walking away undefeated.
Yeah.
But realizing, that guy was too much for me. You know,
that was the end of it. You're like, I had a good run, I'm done.
I can't beat that guy. I mean, Dan Gable was. Do you know anything about wrestling?
No.
Well, Dan Gable was an Olympic. The tragedy of Mark Chiarella.
Yeah.
It's interesting I'm talking about the tragedy. I mean, he was like, it was like when he wrestled, we had wrestling meets in my high school, Farmington High School, Farmington, Michigan.
Yeah.
It was packed.
Yeah.
And people were there just to see him toy with the opponent.
He was that good.
He was that good.
Yeah.
Well, and the colleges were lined up.
Yeah.
And he was all set to go to the Olympics. And guess what?
He broke something.
Jimmy Carter boycotted the Olympics.
Oh, and he got cut out.
Olympics. He didn't get to go. To make weight, to make it happen, to time it right.
Yeah.
Never got a chance. But went on to coach and had a big career.
Yeah, but he missed his moment because of global politics.
Because of global politics.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So where do you take the turn to acting?
Failure. I failed at other things.
But it sounds like you're.
No.
You got out of wrestling at the right time.
Yeah, well, I determined I was going to lose. I didn't even attempt to challenge. You know, I went the other way. I went, ooh, the path of least resistance. I'm not even going to.
But baseball and football, and that, you didn't have a shot with those?
I did. I'm figuring out how to deal with this, thinking about this whole situation.
Yeah.
I wanted to play college football.
Yeah.
I wanted to play college baseball.
Yeah.
I got an opportunity to walk on at the Bowling Green State University.
Yeah.
And I just had a lot of stuff going on that was emotional, and I was very immature, and my family moving around, and I didn't do well.
But you weren't getting in trouble.
I didn't get in trouble, but I wasn't doing well. Yeah. I wasn't emotionally. I was just a very immature person.
Yeah.
And
so acting was perfect.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had done acting when I was a kid. I mean, I had played Peter Pan in third grade. I was the star.
Oh, how'd that feel?
That felt fantastic.
Flying around?
I'm flying around. Hey, I'm Peter Pan from Never Neverland. That was my first line. Yeah. But, you know, I growing up in Georgia in the woods, and I heard your interview with Eric. I thought it was interesting because while Eric was doing all that, Eric Roberts, I'll drop a name. We have the same attorney. Eric's a great guy. We worked on Scorpion together, a show I did on CBS. While he was doing all that, I was down there. I never got to run into him and his family, but they had that.
The playhouse
that they had going. I think when you lose dreams.
Yeah.
Like, I thought I was going to play college football. Yeah. And then I realized this is not going to work.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get killed out here. And I'm just not fast enough. Yeah. I'm just not big enough.
When you realize the limitations of your talent in a particular thing, it's a hard hit.
I didn't have a will. Yeah. It's a tough thing for kids.
Yeah. My brother had to do it with tennis. It's brutal.
It's brutal.
Or you just, it's not anything, it's not your fault that you're physically not gifted in the way necessary to take you to the next level. That realization sort of like, look, I've worked hard, but I just don't got the genetics or the fucking physical gift to be a pro or whatever.
But whatever your dreams, wherever you think you're going to, the dreams are going to take you, and you put all that stock in football and baseball.
Yeah.
That football... You know, I ran like a 4.7 40. I was 215 pounds. I'm just 6 foot. I took a couple of hits. Here's what happened. I took a couple of hits. I was feeling very isolated there. Yeah. Summer football.
Yeah.
They invited me to walk on.
Yeah.
And
walk on means like sort of like, you know,
we're not getting a scholarship, but we've seen film on you and we think you would be an asset to the team.
So you go up there.
So you go up there and you start working out and then you start practicing and playing, and then you realize, it dawned on me, I'm going to be on the scout team.
Yeah.
And the scout team is basically, I'm going to be running, I was a fullback linebacker, I was going to be running plays, and I was going to be getting pulverized by the number one defense, bigger, faster guys.
Yeah.
I took a couple hits.
Yeah.
I started talking to some of the other guys that were around. They had, you know, I'm on my third knee surgery. Yeah. I'm 28 years old and I'm a redshirt freshman, you know, and all that kind of shit. And you're going like,
so you're just going to be a punching bag if you stay.
Exactly. Yeah. And I realized it. And I said, fuck this.
Yeah.
I don't have the heart.
Yeah.
And I quit.
Yeah. Why would anyone volunteer for that?
Well, a lot of people do because they want to hang on to those dreams.
Yeah.
You know, that's that Rudy moment of, you know, maybe I'll get a chance to play someday. I'm going to hang in there and I'm going to play for Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that really means something to, and God bless them.
Yeah.
You got to have something to get through to believe in.
So in that moment, you're devastated and you're like, yeah, I got
it. Fuck. And then what happened was like a domino effect. It affected school. I didn't give a shit about being there. I was completely lost. And I even though I had moved around so much and I'd always had sports to fall back on where I would endear myself to other people like, hey, he's a good baseball player, he's a good football player, blah, 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 blah. I didn't have that ability. I was just one of the faces in the crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, charm's only going to get you so far, right?
Get you pretty far.
You're pretty good. I like you. I knew I'd like this.
Don't underestimate charm.
I got blackballed by the fraternity I was trying to join.
What happened there?
It was alcohol and drugs.
Yeah, you're too much. At least you were excelling in something.
I think I destroyed the bathroom at the fraternity house. I literally had some violent thing and I broke a... I was kind of... Yeah, I was very fucked up.
So you were like...
I broke up with my girlfriend during that time. I'd had this long relationship.
So the booze was hitting you early.
I was a teenage alcoholic. I started drinking at 13.
So it sounds like it made you angry? You became the Hulk? Or what happened?
I did.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I liked the coke, you know, and I just liked... there was something about... I think at my worst, I really think the attempt was to feel normal. And, you know, what I would do is, you know, my first bottom was psychosis because of cocaine. Mm. You know, I didn't sleep. I did a lot of blow. Mm. I drank a lot. Mm. You know, but I'm not innately a violent guy. Mm. But I just saw it like, you know, if I could just get a couple lines of me and then, you know, just a couple beers and get that balance. There was a moment where I'm like, oh, look at me. I'm ready to go.
It was like that golf shot.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm in the sweet spot.
Exactly. And then you just chase it, and you're alone in the bar at 2 in the morning, jacked, just no one in the place, and you're like, something's going to turn around. This is going to get good in a minute. I wasn't really violent, but, the blackouts, they kind of scare you, and, you know, and... But I was not the destroy everything kind of guy. I was the destroy myself kind of guy.
I think ultimately I was so disappointed in myself that I was destroying myself. You know, it's funny, Mark.
Yeah.
I never smoked weed in high school.
Yeah.
But I was a real excessive beer drinker.
Well, yeah, that stuff, you know, you get to a point. Like, I was the kind of guy, here's a good example. I didn't like beer, so I would, you know, chug, like, you know, half pints of Jack Daniels. And I'd be out with my friends driving around like an idiot in high school.
Yeah.
And they'd go to a party, and they'd throw me on the lawn next door because I couldn't hold it.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be, you know, running around breaking things. I'd be the guy on the lawn next door, and someone would run into the party and go, there's some guy dead on the lawn next door. I'd ruin the night for everybody.
Shit.
I wasn't a fun guy.
I remember I got some gal. We went to somebody's party.
Yeah.
Me and a couple other guys. Right. I turned on to alcohol. And I had a car. And I almost got my ass whooped by some girl's dad because I was a fucking asshole at a party.
Yeah.
In Detroit. In Farmington where I was growing up. And, yeah, I think it's a generational thing. Our generation, we grew up in the 60s.
70s.
I was a 60s guy, yeah, so I graduated high school in 77. But I was 12 years old in 1970.
So you saw the whole culture changing.
Yeah.
It was drug time.
It was all, and I thought it was accepted behavior, and I got away with it, and my parents didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah.
It was an innocent time. We didn't have fentanyl and all that kind of bullshit.
Well, that's the weird thing about that.
And I say innocent, but I mean, it was like we were all smoking, you know, everybody was in high school, but I didn't do that until I got to college. And I think that really fucked me up when I went to college.
The weed?
Oh, fuck yeah. Totally robbed me of any micro of ambition that I had was just stolen. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm a wagon baker now.
Yeah, well, it's not stolen.
I'm going to go to college.
It lives in your head.
Yeah.
You get everything done. You get everything.
That's a great line.
It's all going on. It's not happening.
Yeah, I can't present it to anybody yet, but here it is.
Yeah, I'm ready to go. I've got it all mapped out.
Oh, God, it's so good in here. Shit. Oh, my God.
Oh, that's the worst. Where you a lot of people, I always say that it's a will killer, man. Weed, because you know
it's just, and
I see it with other people. I see it now. People are like, oh yeah, I'm going to do the writing, and I'm like, how's that going? You know,
but there's people
who can do it
that are highly functional.
Yeah, yeah.
That I for whatever reason I perceive that they do a lot of.
Sure.
I'll throw out, I feel bad, but I guess Snoop Dogg smokes a lot of weed. He seems to be doing okay.
Well, I think if you figure out what your lane is, you know, and you can handle it. But like if you're, you know, insecure to begin with and you don't have any real confidence in your creativity, the weed will just, you know, it just becomes this cycle of things that happens in your head that never get realized.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, it's everyone's different. But that guy knew what he was going to do early on, you know, and the weed was just sort of stop the noise so he could make his thing.
Yeah, you're right.
Some guys with the drugs, like they, it just, you know, like, you know, Hedberg, who, you know, died from heroin. I mean, like, I completely understand Mitch Hedberg. He's a great comic, and I completely understand it because you watch his style, and it's not unlike jazz musicians, where it's like if you can shut out the noise and you know what you want to do, and that drug will just kind of stop all the other distractions. I mean, you can. There's genius there. I mean, I'm not suggesting it as a system. I know, dude.
Are you doing that?
Yeah.
Let me try one.
How are you with him?
I don't know. What is it?
It's just nicotine, but it's like a pouch. You can put like a dip.
What's going to happen? My blood pressure's going to go up?
I don't know. Let's not. I'm not going to turn you on to drugs on the show. I mean,
I'm interested in that. I'm a cigar guy.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, you are? Like daily?
Yeah, but I do. I smoke one a day. But I don't want to call you out on that, but
I talk about it all the time.
A lot of people be doing that
I'm a nicotine addict fucking through and through.
I'm a nicotine guy.
I can't fucking get off it.
Well, I have to. That's part of my process for acting. The only way I can study dialogue, and I'm good at dialogue, and I'm very good at expositional dialogue. But the only way I can do it to sit still long enough to study is
cigar.
Hey, man, it's sometimes a four cigar a night kind of situation.
Oh, so you know you're used to getting sweaty.
Oh, you know, I mean, it's like. If I got to be here for 4 hours, I mean, you know, I got to be here all day long.
You have a pretty good tolerance, I'm assuming.
I'm pretty good.
I mean, because, like, I do, like, these things. I was off nicotine. I haven't smoked a cigarette in, like, a long time.
You miss them, don't you?
Not cigarettes, but I'll get into cigars. But the thing is, because I'm a fucking addict, like, I know what's going to happen. Yeah, I know that if I, well, thanks, man. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You like these ones?
It's okay. Yeah. I prefer Cuban. I can't tell you.
Which Cubans do you like?
Partagas Series D number 4.
Oh, those are great.
Yeah, those are really good.
Yeah.
I don't know where I get them. Somebody's a friend of mine's grandmother.
Oh, yeah. 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 Or that place where they got them in the back room.
I don't know if I
they're around. I was just in Canada. I had a fucking.
Well, up there it's legal.
Yeah, it's legal, but like they're not what they used to, man. They're not what they used to be, the Cubans. But the Partagas, those ones hold up pretty good. Monte Cristos hold up pretty good. But like Cohibas.
Lusitanias. Lusitanias.
Oh, what is that?
Partagas.
Oh, yeah. The huge ones.
Casa del Habanos.
Well, the thing.
You know, those all got bought by China, by the way.
What?
The Chinese bought all the Casa del Habanos, all the Cuban cigar places
they
around
did?
The world. Yeah, they bought them all.
Well, like the farms in Cuba?
They bought the stores.
Oh, okay.
So they're buying all the cigars.
Okay. But
that's what I heard. Rumor has it in the cigar world.
Well, as long as the sun is relatively the same in Cuba where they do what they do. Yeah, that's what you're going for. Like the dealer is unimportant.
I'm getting it. As long as the product is good.
Right?
Right.
How many times have you been in a situation where this guy's making me nervous, but I think he's got the good shit.
This guy's, don't worry about it, he's good.
yeah. He's not going to bother you. Just don't look at it. It's what that Cheech and Chong thing. Just don't say anything about the scar. Yeah, all right. So, yeah, you don't have to do this now. But
I won't, but I'm curious about this.
My point was, like,
I think that will jack my blood pressure. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Do you meditate?
No.
I've started meditation.
Yeah?
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, what do you do?
I'm only doing 7 minutes, but what I do is I literally make myself sit down, get in a... rest my hands on my knees and sit there and focus on my breathing.
Yeah.
And just try to keep all the thoughts out of my head as much as I can, keep focused on my breathing.
The funny thing is I was doing it a little bit during the pandemic with a sort of a recorded meditation thing. And it was funny because my experience was, you know, after a couple of minutes, you know, turning the thoughts off, I'm like, I'm fucking nailing this.
Yeah.
This is no problem. I got this. Nothing about nothing.
I'm not nailing it yet. I'm still new enough at it, but I really enjoy trying to do it. Because my mind, you sound like we kind of, my mind, non-stop. There's so many things that I've wanted to do in my life that I haven't been able to fucking focus on.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
that the one thing that I did choose to do in my life has worked out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but, me too.
But there's all this other things that I think I might be good at that I want to try. And come to find out, singing's one of them.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing about meditation and how we're talking about it. It's like that moment where I realized that, like, I think I got the hang of it.
I'm nailing this.
Yeah, that was the end of it.
7 minutes.
That was the end of it.
Done.
What do I need to do this every day for? I got this.
Fuck.
I understand the benefits.
Fuck, I got it down. I don't have to worry about this shit.
Like, it's sort of like that moment with the rest where you knew you were good. Why push it?
Yeah. I was undefeated.
Yeah, I'm good.
I wasn't going to let this guy take that from me. Fuck you. He was good, man.
Anyway. So you're spinning around and you're lost.
Yeah. I was failing at a lot of things, and I don't really know how I turned it all around. I think it's interesting.
But you chose acting.
I know. I left college. I went home. Oh, I feel like I'm doing like a fucking therapy session.
That's all right.
It's one reason I don't do a lot of these podcasts.
Let's look at it as a small meeting.
Okay, we'll do it as a meeting. Well, I'll make this positive for people. I can do this way. Yeah, here's what I'll do.
It's about what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now.
What it's like now.
A message of hope.
A message of hope. I've given it to you. I went home. I could see how I was the number one son. I was a great athlete. My father was hugely disappointed. Hugely disappointed at my disastrous academic achievement at this school.
Right.
And he said, "What the fuck?" Yeah. And I went,
"I know.
I got a problem. I got a lot of problems. I'm emotionally immature. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no direction.
Yeah.
I've lost everything. I'll get it together somehow." And
what do you say to that?
Good luck.
Yeah.
You better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think he was a nice guy about it. He was like, "Well, son, you've got to try out. You've got to, you know."
They can only say what they can say, yeah.
I started working at a bank. Immediately downtown.
Doing what?
I was a wire transfer specialist. I started to realize I don't want to be in a cubicle my whole life.
Did your dad get you that gig?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't.
Seems like a weird turn for you.
It wasn't his bank.
Yeah.
So it was a weird turn. I started working out at a health spa, a Gold's Gym kind of a thing. And somebody asked me to do a commercial for that thing.
Yeah.
And then somebody else had asked me to do some photos, like modeling, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and I started thinking, like, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed acting. And I really started, I didn't know anybody in Cleveland, so I really had a lot of time to focus on me. And I started reading books, Stanislavski, and I really love the movies.
Yeah.
It had always been a part of my life.
Yeah.
My parents had taken me to that. And I was like, I wonder what, I tell you what, Mark, I knew I wanted to do something big for me.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to do something big I wanted to see if I could do something. If these other things didn't work out, there's still something else out there that I want to do. And I really started focusing on that. And
did you take classes?
No. I read books. I did a couple of local things in Cleveland. And on that premise.
On the health club commercial.
Which, I mean, come
you nailed
on.
It.
But I remember my mother and father just like, "You're kidding me. You're going to do what?"
Yeah.
And there was no encouragement. It was all discouragement. And you're going to fail. You're going to get into drugs.
Yeah.
You're going to be doing pornos.
Yeah.
You're going to be, come on, we can't help you with this. They were petrified by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it all just hit me as a negative thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you learn you can't really tell anybody about this shit because you got to keep this close to your vest.
Yeah,
you can't tell people what you're going to do.
Yeah, because they'll shit on it.
They'll shit on it. Your own family will steal your dreams.
Yeah.
They'll take them from you.
Yeah, it's like that.
They'll claim now that, I was always behind you.
We are very proud of them.
Yeah. I never forget when my father said, my father said to Arnold Schwarzenegger at the night of the Terminator 2 premiere, my father says, "So you think my son will make it?" And you just go like, and you're standing there going like, "Wow, Jesus Christ." Thanks, Dad.
Arnold must have been encouraging.
He was sweet. He said to my dad, he said, yes, Robert has a very good work ethic. He's very good. He's very strong, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, he will do. What is make it? You know, as far as I was concerned, when I got to Hollywood, the guys that I looked to that I really admired, the guys that I fell in with when I came to Hollywood, they were probably making $30,000 a year.
Who's that?
I don't really want to drop these guys' names.
Well, are they around still?
Yeah.
Oh, that's all right.
Well, you
got a crew.
One that no longer involved in my life, I don't feel like that's fair.
Okay.
But guys that I knew that were professional actors that were making a living of it, and the way they were doing it was like they gig and they go on unemployment. And I thought, well, that'd be cool if you could just do that.
Right.
That'd be great.
Work every once in a while and just kind of lay around.
And
until
play
then.
Golf, because at the time I was playing golf.
I love this secret golf life that you had.
Yeah.
And you turned on it.
Yeah.
So you get hooked up with Corman? How's that happen?
A buddy of mine where I was waiting tables.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He said Roger's still at it?
Well, this was 1984.
Right, but that's like, 30 years into his thing.
Oh, fuck yeah. But he was still making movies.
Oh, I know. I interviewed him.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah. When he was in his 80s.
It was a much better interview than this one, I'm sure.
No, this is great.
No, it's not. I understand. No. I'm just saying that.
No, it's good. I'm getting a lot out of it.
You're seeing how sane you are.
Yeah. This is working for me.
I kind of needed
a meeting this today. I thought this will work.
Well, a buddy of mine, Christopher Monza, was working for Roger Corman.
Yeah.
And I was waiting tables at La Strega on 4th and Western.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, man, they're casting this biker movie. They need some extras.
Ah.
And I went, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you riding at that time?
Well, I had a motorcycle.
Yeah.
I didn't have a Harley.
Right. It's hard to admit that, huh?
It is hard to admit that. I was riding a Japanese bike.
Yeah, well.
Fuck.
What, a Honda?
I'm not gonna give any other brand other than Harley Davidson my endorsement. The good thing about the Japanese influx of bikes that happened in the 60s and 70s is they got a lot of people on two wheels. And then those people that got on two wheels discovered
the Harleys.
Harley Davidson.
Some guys were always Harley guys.
Some guys were.
So it was a mindset.
Is that me or you?
Probably you.
That's the president of the Booze Fighters Motorcycle Club chapter in Los Angeles.
Yeah. You got to go make a hit. You got to go.
It's not that kind of motorcycle club.
Is it a 12-step call? You got to get the guys.
It's not a sober club either.
Oh, it's not?
No.
All right.
It's a 1946, a 78-year-old motorcycle club founded in Los Angeles, California.
Yeah.
International Motorcycle Club.
Why is it called the Booze Fighters?
Well, you want to really know?
Yeah.
Okay, so they were all sitting in a bar. One of them had been kicked out of the 13 Rebels Motorcycle Club.
Yeah.
A guy by the name of Wino Willie Faulkner, who was a veteran who came of World War II.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a name for their new club.
Yeah.
And one of the guys, Walt Porter, was in the bar, and he said, well, all you guys do is fight the bottle.
Hmm.
And each other.
Mm-hmm.
You should call yourselves the Booze Fighters.
It's got nothing to do with sobriety.
Absolutely zilch.
Wow, here I thought, like, that's an interesting approach to helping people. Nope.
Nope. None whatsoever. A lot of people ask me about it, and I say, well, yeah, I'm sober.
Yeah.
28 years.
Yeah.
But the club is...
just a bunch of maniacs.
Full-functioning group of... There's a lot of sober guys within the club. It's an interesting club. It's been around before.
The Angels?
I'm not going to say any other club, but it's been around since 1946.
Did you see that movie, the Bike Riders? The movie with the...
I did, yeah.
How'd that land with you?
There were some interesting things with it.
Historically?
Yeah, there were some interesting things.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that book.
Yeah.
And Danny Lyons is the photographer.
Yeah, I
have that book and had that book and... It's one of those times where you're kind of going like, wait a minute, they're making a movie about that book?
Yeah.
And then you realize, I've had that book for 40 years.
Yeah.
Why didn't I write the fucking movie? That's where I go. Why am I so, why didn't I think of that? Why the fuck did I let that guy think of that? I get so much resentment towards somebody instead of like giving the guy a
credit. Yeah, it's like I could have fucking, if I had just.
If I would have just.
What the fuck?
So anyway, once I get past that and go like, well, good for him.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long journey.
I applaud you for you're gonna write a screenplay to these black and white photographs and you're gonna turn it into something.
Isn't it funny though when you have that innately, instinctually, it's just resentment immediately. So the journey to just being able to be gracious and then like when you do it, you kind of walk away from it going like, I deserve a fucking where's my medal?
Nailed it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sorry. It's all right.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I got that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I behaved like a human today.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So.
I the movie was great. The Harleys were great in it. The bikes were great.
Yeah.
Big fan of Tom Hardy and Jodie Comer, I thought, was phenomenal. The actress.
Oh, my God.
Her accent was fantastic. Oh, so you saw it, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Did you see it on the big screen?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I mean, the acting was sort of amazing. She was amazing.
She was amazing.
Hardy, like, he's a great actor, but sometimes he makes choices that are almost too subtle. You know, and then, you know, Butler, you know, he's a real attractive guy, you know, but she was just locked the fuck in and just putting everybody to shame.
Yeah. I appreciate all your comments.
I do. You're not going to chime in, though.
I hesitate to. If you're anybody that's successful in this business, I give them a lot of credit, as I know you do too.
Oh no,
I
definitely.
Hesitate to. I don't like.
You can't judge the performance. Like I'm about to do this movie, and I feel like I'm going to fuck the whole thing.
What's the movie?
It's a dark comedy. What you looking for a part?
I'm an actor. I mean, I think I can do anything. I mean,
yeah, I'm very nervous about it because it's a lead, and like I just do not think that.
Do you have an acting coach?
No.
You ever had an acting coach?
No.
I have an acting coach.
Yeah.
You know, my early years with Roger Corman, it was trial by fire. That's how I learned.
So you were the extra, and then how'd that unfold?
I ended up going to Roger Corman Studios, Hammond Lumber, which is my middle name. So I felt like, ooh, there's something.
Yeah. Look at that. Yeah. Synchronicity.
Hammond Lumber.
No coincidence there.
Oh, that's interesting. And the director saw me and he said, hey, I want you to come read for this.
Yeah.
And literally I read it on the spot, cold reading. I went in and acted with the guy that had been cast in the lead.
Yeah.
Fucking did this off the hook audition.
Yeah.
I literally grabbed the guy by the front of his shirt, threw him over my knee to the floor. I mean, I acted out the scene for real. I cleared the guy at the director's desk. I just went violent.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, Clark Henderson was his name, director. He went, you're hired.
Yeah.
I had my first.
Don't hurt me.
Supporting
you're
lead,
hired.
Supporting lead role. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Supporting lead role. Yeah. And we shot it out at Indian Dunes.
Yeah.
Which is real close to my new location of my dealership.
Yeah.
And it was right after Vic Morrow and the whole Jim Landis thing and all that kind of thing. It was 1984.
And you did a few movies with Corman?
I did like six.
Wow.
Six movies with Roger, I think. And I asked for my SAG card, and Hollywood Boulevard Part 2 was my SAG card.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, shipped off to the Philippines, did a bunch of movies there, and really learned
how to be on a set. Yeah.
I learned a lot and would, you know, was not very forthcoming about anything because I was so insecure about the lack of training, but I thought by sure will I'm athletic enough to do the stunts and you know there's got to be a way I can break out.
Yeah.
And I had done one play and I was doing another play and I got, you know, that builds confidence, you know.
Doing theater. Yeah.
And then, you know, a lot of good people around me that were telling me I had something, and I believed them.
Yeah.
Just a kind word from people that
I think you got to believe them.
What time is it?
I don't know.
Fuck, I got to keep an eye on the time.
Why, what are you doing? 11.
I got an air conditioning guy come over to my house at noon.
Oh, yeah?
So I gotta kind of keep an eye. How long is this supposed to go?
I don't know.
Oh, you just go. I know you're going to make this, you're going to edit this and make it all good, right?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Good.
We'll probably cut it down to about, you know, 20.
20 minutes? So.
I'm kidding.
this is a fascinating experience.
Well, what about the acting coach now?
Oh, I was going to tell you that after I had done
I had done Copland.
That was great, man. You were great in that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're always good.
Thank you. I appreciate that. James Mangold, great guy. I thought that
movie was like, it's an underrated movie, and I know it got a little chaotic, but like you were great. Everybody was great.
I loved making that movie. That's one of my favorite experiences. And then another James Mangold movie is one of my other favorite experiences, Walk the Line with Joaquin Phoenix. So
you played Johnny's dad, right?
I was Johnny's dad.
Yeah, yeah.
So while I was doing a film, I met an acting coach named Stephen Bridgewater, who became a very good friend of mine. And I think the greatest thing that Stephen did for me was he eliminated my insecurities. And for that, I'm so grateful that I met him. I wished I'd met him earlier in my career.
And they're gone?
Yeah. I'm pretty bulletproof now.
Wow. And, how do you do that?
He basically just told me I'm good. I mean, it was really like having somebody kind of acknowledging, like...
But acknowledging, you could hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to going like, fuck it. Yeah,
No. He cut through all the bullshit. I mean, it was like, there was a way in which he did. It's not that he didn't give me some technique and things to work on, like the Alexander technique. You know, the secret with acting, I'm sure Mr. Pacino told you, is relaxation.
Uh-huh.
And you have to get to that point of relaxation where you quiet your brain. Yeah. You're not worried about, am I good?
Yeah.
I don't even think about that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You've got to get to that point where you've prepped, you've studied, you've thought about it, you're prepared, now throw it all away and just be relaxed and in the fucking moment.
Yeah.
Then you can get into techniques where it's like, well, where's the camera and which eye do I want to look at?
Yeah.
My breathing's fine. I've got my dialogue and the camera's over Mark's right eye. So I'm camera right. So I'm going to focus on Mark and I'm going to be able to play to that scene that way. And
then,
you know, this technique you can do, you know, relaxation of your face.
Yeah.
You know, if you're always like mugging and doing shit, that doesn't work 35 times as big. You need to kind of just, you want to have people look into your eyes.
Yeah.
And if you watch people, what are you riveted by when you're watching somebody? What Stephen taught me was you've got to relax your face and you want to bring the audience in with your eyes. And so you want to start looking at your environment and what's all there. So if it's cameras and extras and people, you want to be in the moment and you want all that coming to you.
Right.
You don't want to be looking to get it. You're not like trying to force it in.
Yeah.
You want to be receptive.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it. So how you can do that and the less eye blinking and just fixing and just being able to deliver your lines without moving and hands and all that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And just deliver.
Yeah.
That has the biggest impact.
And then like you've already put in place where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you learn that? What movie was that?
I think the first performance I did having brought Mr. Bridgewater in to help me with Sopranos.
Jesus Christ, that guy was great.
And I will give you a little insight on that. My career was going in a way that, you know, it's... you get opportunities and then you've got kids, you've got responsibilities, you've got things going on and your artistic integrity is not as good as... it's based on your financial integrity.
Sure.
And I was always a poor guy. So I was always looking for what's my next buck.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of movies that are shit that, you know, hey.
Well, you want to work. You're still acting.
I'm still acting and I want to work. And I got to make money. And this is how I make money. And you know, and I got to support my family.
Yeah.
But, you know, you say that to yourself. Anyway.
But like after Terminator 2, were you typecast?
Yeah, I was.
So you had to get out from under that.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny that you said it the way you just said it because it really hit me. I was.
Yeah. And so you had to figure out.
I don't think I've ever admitted that to anybody.
You know?
Man, you're good. But I, you know, the first gigs were, you know, and the other thing was, Mark, if I walked in, And I started to catch on. Oh, I look like the guy from Terminator 2. Oh yeah, well I am that guy. Yeah. And that's all their perception is, because I was an unknown when I got that role.
Yeah.
And that was the only way people perceived me. Who is this guy? They didn't go look at my Roger Corman bullshit.
No.
None of them had ever seen the plays I'd done. They had no idea what I used to look like or whatever. Yeah. They just saw me as that.
Yeah.
Oh fuck.
The guy.
Yeah. So
the menace.
It was Robert Lieberman, and I had grown. I realized after a year and a half of not getting cast in anything, from after T2,
yeah.
You think I'd have all this momentum.
Right.
I was beginning to think it was a fluke, and I went like, "Fuck."
Yeah.
And I grew my hair long.
Yeah.
I grew a beard, and I gained weight. And
yeah.
I went in and I auditioned for Fire in the Sky, and I got cast by Robert Lieberman.
Yeah.
And that kind of. That kind of got things going. But getting back to The Sopranos and working with Steven, he knew about The Sopranos. I had met David Chase a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it was to do a movie with Jewel, too, to be honest with you. We met at Lucy's El Adobe. I remember that. And David remembered me from that meeting and thought about casting me and called me and said, you know, we want to cast you in this role.
Yeah.
And it was Steven Bridgewater who said, you've got to do it. And I looked at it, and it was such a change.
Totally.
I mean, you're vulnerable. You're a little bitch. They're going to slap throw you around.
Desperate,
you're not the
desperate.
Menace. You're pathetic.
Yeah.
All that kind of shit.
Yeah.
So Steven took me to Gamblers Anonymous, and I started meeting all these guys that were little guys that in their heads they were John Wayne when they were playing cards
right.
and shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it all started to make sense to me. Anyway, long story short, I had a film that was at the Venice Film Festival. I had prepped. I had shot scenes with Steven on video. I had video of it, of scenes that I was going to be doing with James to reference.
Yeah.
I was so prepped and ready for those guys.
Yeah.
That when I got to Silver Cup Studios in Queens, I was off book. They had a read through. I went, I'm meeting all the guys, and they're looking at me. This is the start of the second season.
Yeah, it's huge.
I don't even think they knew how big they were.
Yeah, right.
Yet.
Yeah.
They knew. Anyway, they hadn't gone to the Emmys yet.
Yeah.
And they're doing a read through, and I'm seeing, oh shit, they're reading the scripts like right away, like looking to see if they're dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm off book.
Yeah.
I'm so fucking ready.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, you could see actors sizing you up like, what the fuck is he here for?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know if there was any of that.
Yeah.
But well, you kind of.
Sure. It comes from the same place as resentment.
Damn. You're good.
It's like it's this internal monologue.
This internal monologue is going on. But the read-through was great.
Yeah.
And that whole experience, it changed my career because everybody in Hollywood was watching.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they saw that and they went.
He can do anything.
Hey, he's a fucking actor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, what was it about James?
Oh, I loved working with him.
Yeah.
I purposely pushed him to be able to have him throw me around.
Yeah.
I kind of went, you know, hey, I taunted him. I said, you know, we're going to be shooting that scene pretty soon, and you better have your A game. And he kind of did one of the, we were outside smoking a cigarette for a minute, so he looked at me kind of went, oh, I have my fucking A game. He flicked his cigarette at me and walked off and came in the next day, and he was lit up. He literally said to me, he said, how's your balls?
Yeah.
And I'm kind of sitting at that chair where he comes in there.
Yeah.
Where he finds me at the computer. Yeah. And he says, how's your balls? And I said, they're good, James. How are you? Or I said, how's yours? And he went, I'm hungover. Let's fucking shoot this scene. And I went, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm already going, oh, fuck, what did I do? Because he's
ready to.
He's fucking, and I can't fight back.
Yeah.
I really, and you know what was funny, Mark? I had lost weight purposely for Billy Bob Thornton. I was doing a movie with him called All the Pretty Horses.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Billy had asked me, You know, you play Matt Damon's father. You're a World War II veteran, and you gotta lose weight and be really anemic. And yeah. You're almost near death. You're still smoking. That's what he said to me. He said, yeah. You're still smoking. I went, yeah, Billy, I'm still smoking. He said, okay, good. Keep smoking.
Yeah.
So that's when that all happened. At the same time, and they asked me to do The Sopranos. So
you're lean.
I'm so vulnerable too.
Yeah.
Because when you're not eating, you don't feel
raw.
Don't feel forceful.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not intimidating. You're kind of.
Yeah.
So I was like that.
Yeah.
And
it really worked for the worm
Christ.
Character.
One fucking take, man.
Yeah.
He came in with such get up. We didn't rehearse.
Yeah.
Get up. You know, we're shooting the rehearsal.
Yeah.
That whole scene's for real. Yeah. I'm fucking like throwing me around. I'm just being conscious of like, I'm being thrown around. He's throwing me up here on this wall. No, hit me. I didn't know if he's going to hit me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it really, and I let my mind get into it and really went for it. It was so much fun. James ended up, we got along really well. I ended up having lunch at one of the Sopranos things with him and his father and getting to meet his dad. And he was a really, really great guy.
Yeah. I just
Such
watched
a
that.
Sweetheart.
I watched that doc about Chase and the Sopranos.
Yeah.
And it was so
I did too.
Heartbreaking. You know, that how consumed that, you know, Gandolfini got. You know, just to see what he was, you know, before the Sopranos, the way he talked and the way he presented himself and what that role pulled out of him and that he had to live in.
Yeah.
Year after year for what was it, 6 seasons?
6 or 7 seasons.
But that sounds like an amazing experience. And the fact that you were playing, you know, the bottom, you know, the guy who's broken.
Hmm.
I mean, when I saw you do that, I'm like, holy fuck, where's this guy been?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. And that's exactly what happened in Hollywood. It opened a bunch of doors for me.
Yeah.
And also it opened my mind. I realized, God, I've been doing all these shitty movies. Why haven't I ever looked to TV?
Yeah.
And as soon as I did that, I said to my agents, can I, is any TV available? I had a pilot on every network and you know, that I had auditioned for and ended up the X-Files. I walked away with the X-Files when David Duchovny.
And TV was changing. It was changing. A lot of real actors were kind of doing it.
It was weird. It was like George Clooney and a lot of actors were making the jump to movies.
Yeah.
But then there was a lot of us that were kind of finding TV and going, this is better writing than I'm doing.
Yeah.
I mean, not everything's Copland or Walk the Line.
I might be able to come back next season.
Yeah.
You might do a few episodes.
That's where the real money is, in episodic TV.
Yeah.
For actors, my tier.
So what are you doing? What are you working on now?
1923 with Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren.
Wow.
The second season, Taylor Sheridan, prolific writer. And I'm also working for another incredibly prolific writer, director James Gunn.
Yeah.
And DC, in the DC Studios world, DC Comics, we're doing a second season of Peacemaker.
Okay.
So I'm John Cena's father, white supremacist, racist, xenophobe, homophobe. He's just an awful character in the DC world. It's called White Dragon, Arnie Smith. I'm John Cena's father.
Yeah.
And then in 1923, I'm Harrison Ford's, I say I'm his best friend. I am. I'm the sheriff of the town, and he's sort of got me in his hip pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's Jacob Dutton, and Helen Mirren's his wife.
Yeah.
Cara Dutton.
How much does the script inform what you do?
A lot. Yeah, a lot. Everything's based on I have to really know the words.
Yeah.
And I seem to have a real good ability of
keeping
it
in your head.
Yeah, but also finding the character through that.
Yeah.
I find the character through, you know, wardrobe, makeup.
Yeah.
And then I just believe it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And find the truth as fast as I can.
Yeah.
To what I want, you know, and what the scene's about. And every scene's a one-act play. It's a beginning, middle,
you
and gotta end.
Really think about that.
It's a one-act play. Every scene, and you string those together.
Yeah.
And in those scenes, you're going to try to find a moment, you know, and you do your thing.
Yeah.
Some stuff you have to go, okay, this is exposition, so how am I going to deal with this? Well, I'm going to get to it as fast as I fucking can.
Yeah,
you know,
to get to the good stuff.
Sometimes the writers aren't too happy about that. But see, the thing is you want to make everything conversational.
Yeah.
So if it's exposition, I'm going to, well, this is the part where I tell you the story about what we're going to do. Yeah. But if you do it fast and quick and lay it all out there and make it seem like it's a fucking conversation, it just goes.
Yeah.
People get it.
Yeah. This is all helping me. So when does the
can I mention a few other things, because I feel like we're winding down. I'm going to just mention something if you don't mind.
Only if it's your Harley dealership.
Thank you. Harley Davidson of Santa Clarita.
Yeah.
I got my grand opening November 9th.
Yeah.
You're invited.
Thank you.
We'll have a lot of people there. We've my partner Oliver Shoku, Glendale Harley Davidson, is responsible for the Love Ride. He did 34 years of Love Ride. We've had David Grohl. We've had Bruce Springsteen. We've had ZZ
Top. What's the Love Ride?
Love Ride is the largest single day motorcycle fundraising event in the world.
Oh, great.
We've raised over $25 million. He's raised over $25 million doing it for like 34 years. Yeah. Jay Leno is the honorary grand marshal.
Yeah.
Great bands have been involved. And so he's my business partner. He and I bought Harley Davidson of Santa Clarita. We've had the business for 7 years.
How's it going?
It's going great.
Yeah.
It's my passion.
Yeah.
And we're moving it into this new location right on the 5.
Can you take apart a bike and put it back together?
I can take apart a bike. Putting it back together is a little difficult for me, but...
Are the newer bikes complicated?
They're very complicated.
Yeah.
They're very well engineered.
Yeah.
The best motorcycles we've ever produced is Harley Davidson right now.
That's great.
And I ride all over the country. I do that all year round. I do about, three or four. Last year I did about 4 cross-country trips. And that's what I do in between.
Isn't that
gigs.
Meditative?
It's very meditative. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
have you ever ridden a motorcycle?
Yeah.
You like it?
Yeah. Sure.
Have you ever done cross country trip, anything like that? Been out there in the wild?
I was a kid, and my dad was it's funny because my dad had bought a couple of Japanese bikes when I was a kid, a Suzuki 90, a little one, and a mini bike and shit. And, and he was running around with these cops, riding a bit. And then, but he's an orthopedic surgeon. And at some point,
your father's an orthopedic surgeon.
He was. He's not dead, but he's definitely not a surgeon anymore.
How old is he?
He's having a hard time remembering what he ate for breakfast. He's 86.
That's my mom's age.
Yeah. But he, one time, when I was riding, he decided, I need to learn a lesson. He took me to the hospital to show me one of his patients in traction who got into a motorcycle accident that wasn't his fault. And I was like, well, why did you buy me the bike?
Wow.
And that was kind of the end of it.
How do you feel about that?
About him doing that?
Yeah.
Well, he was kind of a worried guy, and he was kind of a manic guy. So he would go for these flights of sort of he'd get all in on something. And then it would just, go away for whatever reason. And I think, the injuries and him having to deal with it, he just got scared and, he put the fear in me. And I get it. I mean, it was concern. It wasn't trying to kill a dream or anything. I was always a little nervous on bikes because, all you got to do, we take it out on the bumpy dirt things. And I knew guys that could jump. And I didn't, I think I always had a sort of lack of confidence. And you can't have a lack of confidence in midair.
Where are you? I'm sorry. Did I ask you this earlier? Where are you from?
I grew up in Albuquerque.
Okay.
But my family's from Jersey. I'm genetically Jersey.
My wife's from Jersey.
Yeah, I'm definitely a Jersey person. But second to grade through high school, I was in Albuquerque. My dad's still out there.
Well, I have friends that are from Albuquerque.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about confidence in those things, I always used to think about, if I was hanging off a cliff...
Wile E. Coyote?
Yeah, what's my move?
Yeah, what's my move hanging off the cliff?
Sadly, it would be like, I'm going to...
You're going to go. You're not going to pull up?
No.
Now you're going to try?
Yeah, I'll try. But I don't know if I'll get up there.
Have you ever been in a life and death situation?
Yeah, maybe on drugs once or twice, but not in a way where I was like, wow, I could have died. Usually it's, timing and, scary girlfriends.
But. Without getting into the story,
but
I was in a boating accident, and that's what changed my life. And I survived and saved 4 other guys' lives in Lake Erie. And it was 2 months later that I moved to Hollywood. That was my wake-up call from God basically saying, you're fucking up, and you better you got one life, and go for it. And that was the impetus that sent me going across.
No shit.
It was that. And you know, I've been out here ever since, and it's worked out. But it was literally a swift kick in the ass, and I was praying for that. I was looking for that.
Yeah,
and it
happened in a dramatic way.
Thankfully, it did happen in a dramatic way, and I really felt like.
Well, what was the second turn? I mean, there must have been another turn where you got sober. That must have been a similar moment.
I got sober to do T2. I realized early on, physically, I was not going to be able to do that movie with my recreational participation in drug sports and other things. And it was expected of me to be able to physically handle this. And there was going to be all sorts of training involved with it. And I didn't tell anybody that I was a daily guy, getting fucked up every day. No one knew that. And I went cold turkey, did the film, and like a dumbass and true alcoholic, I told my wife, I said, as soon as this is over, I'm going to, you know, I want a case of beer. And I'm gonna, and I just turned it on and binged for 4 years. I was just having this conversation with James Gunn the other day.
Yeah.
And
you want me to get that name you dropped, or do you want me to just put it there with Pacino?
I'll put it there with Pacino. By the way, I didn't want to say this, but Pacino's been to my house. Okay. He ate some fried fucking chicken and left it in a garbage can.
All right. There you go.
Anyway.
So James Gunn, you told him the story. 4 years.
Because he's sober, too.
Yeah.
He's been sober since he was 19.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, and it's weird. I did T2, and I accomplished this great, you know, I really participated and accomplished this great thing. And what did I do? I immediately went back to my old ways, went on a binge, started drinking all the time, started doing weed again. And wondered why the fuck aren't I worried? I thought I had this momentum. And I fucked myself for 4 years.
Yeah. Oh, so that had something to do with the...
And then I my wife, I wanted to have kids, and my wife, Barbara, God bless her, she said, there's no way I'm having kids with you unless you clean up your act.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I did it.
And you did it?
I did it.
Still cold turkey? You do the work?
I have a sponsor, I go to the occasional meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
I really feel like it's just a spiritual, the program is really just to fast track to reconnect you with God and spirituality and however you perceive that. And
you grew up with that?
I did. I'm a cradle to grave Episcopalian.
Yeah.
And I believe that. And I feel like that's what the program did. It got me back and I reconnected and, found my faith again.
Yeah.
And I've been good ever since.
I'm happy
Knock
for you.
Wood, bro.
That's great, man. Yeah, we're doing it. 25 years.
You're 25?
25 and godless. Good for you with the God, though.
Yeah. No, it's very important.
Well, I think I have some sort of spirituality.
I'm sure you do. And you know, I think everybody has to have whatever they have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's so easy for me because it's...
You're brought up
with it. I was brought up in it.
It's wired in.
It's genetically pre-wired. Well, I have a you know, you can talk to some of my other family members about their stuff.
Yeah. What? This isn't going to be a full series on you. I don't want to disappoint you, but I'm not going to go interview your family to do 5 episodes.
I didn't mean that. You should bring my brother in.
Oh, yeah. The singer.
Oh, yeah. Multi-platinum recording artist?
Yeah, yeah.
He's fucking fantastic.
Yeah. Well, what would you...
He's a good guy.
What about your family? What would they say about your faith?
They're all for it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Except for...
Yeah. The one?
No.
All right.
You know.
Okay.
He's a good guy. I love him.
All right. Nice talking to you.
Hey, Mark, let me tell you something. We met at the American Airlines Lounge.
Yeah. Locked in right away.
You're everything I thought you were. You're a great guy. Okay. I really enjoyed this. I'm embarrassed. I don't like talking like this.
Yeah.
Fucking make it sound good, buddy. Do something. Save my ass, would you?
Of course.
All right.
All right.
God bless you, bro.
You too.
Thank you.
There you go. That was fun. If you're in the market for a Harley, go to Robert's Place in Santa Clarita. Hang out for a minute.
Hey, folks, on Thursday, I talked to documentary filmmaker Billy Corbin. He directed the new film From Russia with Lev, which was produced by my old Air America co-worker, Rachel Maddow. If you want to go back and listen to my talk with Rachel from 2019, it's episode 1062.
It's hard for me to see you as the person that I used to see hanging around Air America because now, because like when I met you, I think you had a crew cut and... and you wore a baseball hat a lot.
Yeah,
you're a little heavier.
Yeah,
and and you were just always, leaning over a lot of papers.
Yeah, I have a backpack full of paper that I brought with me to talk to you today. If that would make you more comfortable get into that thing.
No, it never.
I might even have a hat.
Oh, good. It wouldn't make me more comfortable. It would be give me that same feeling I got back then. I'm like, should I be working more? Is there? She's. I just read a few things. Isn't that enough?
But did I seem like the same? I mean, not where did my workout seem the same, but do I seem like the same person, personality-wise?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think, you seem more confident, and that you would hope that would happen.
Is
it interesting?
I don't feel more confident.
You don't?
No.
That's episode 1062 with Rachel Maddow, and you can listen to it for free wherever you're listening to this episode right now. To get all episodes of WTF ad-free, sign up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. I looped some basic blues.
Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.